Okay, well, here's a good question for Christmas. Who is Jesus? Or what do you see when you look at Jesus? It's a question asked by the passage today, and in many ways it's the main question that we've been looking at over these past few months as we've made our way through the first few chapters of John's Gospel. Because the thing is, John wrote his Gospel to answer exactly that question, and he tells us that if you work your way through all the way to the end of chapter 20. And what we've been doing over these last 8 or 9 weeks is we've been having a look through various windows to piece together the jigsaw, to help us see the full picture of who Jesus is, as revealed to us by the evidence that John presents. So, you know, if you picked up a camera and just walked down Regent Street today asking people who they thought Jesus was, you'd obviously get a wide variety of answers. At this time of year, you may well get people saying he was born in a manger, a miracle baby who, if you believe the words of away in a manger, he never cried. Or if you waited a few months to Easter, you'd probably hear he was a guy who died on a cross and managed to conjure up a remarkable disappearing act from the tomb where he was buried. Then you'd probably hear the normal things, that he was a good teacher or a good example to follow, or a healer or a miracle worker, or a prophet even, particularly if you talk to a Muslim. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you'd be told that he was a swear word. And you're bound to have more than a few who would say, well, sorry, mate, haven't got a clue, and I don't really give a monkeys. And the thing is, you can understand that, because it's 2,000 years since Jesus walked the earth. And so for many, getting through the next day seems far more important than thinking about whether Jesus really is the answer to the meaning of life. On the other hand, though, if you were to go back and walk down a busy street in first century Palestine, you'd be far less likely to get that sort of apathy, because Jesus was causing quite a stir. And so whatever you thought of him, the chances are you would have to form some sort of opinion on who he really was. And yet the thing is that even though it was 2,000 years ago and he was doing some extraordinary things right in their midst, the opinions you'd have got then would actually have been remarkably similar to the opinions you get today in Regent Street. You can read a few of them as you read through the Gospels. He's a good man, a wise man, a teacher, a miracle worker, a prophet even. And of course, all of these are true. They are all windows into who Jesus really was and is. But the point is that these things aren't enough. There's much, much more to Jesus than any of those things individually, or even all those things put together. And what John does is he picks up on these various windows and says, yes, he is that, but you see, he's far more than that. Last week we were in Samaria and we were looking through the window of Jesus, the teacher and the prophet. This week we're back in Galilee, and it's Jesus, the miracle worker, that we're looking at. And in both cases, John is saying, yes, you see that piece of the jigsaw, but are you putting it all together? Can you see the full picture? So let's have a recap on what's going on. Jesus has gone and ruffled the Pharisees' feathers in Judea back in chapter 3. And so he heads back home to Galilee. But what happens on the way is that he passes through Samaria and he meets a woman at a well, and he makes such an impact with her and the Samaritans in general that he ends up staying there for a couple of days before he finally sets out for Galilee in verse 43. And then, as we get to verse 44, we come across these words in brackets. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honour in his own country. And that takes us into the sort of, I guess it's sort of upside-down world, really, of who actually sees what's going on here and who doesn't. Because what's demonstrated time and time again is that those who should be able to grasp who Jesus is most clearly, they're the very ones who just don't get it. So if you go back to Nicodemus, for example, back in chapter 3, he's a member of the Jewish ruling council, and he sees that Jesus is a teacher and a performer of signs. But then he seems completely and utterly lost when Jesus starts giving him a deeper explanation of who he really is and how he needs to respond. And then on the other hand, last week, we saw that Jesus received a very warm welcome from the Samaritans, and they were the mixed-race heretics despised by the Jews. And yet in spite of that, if you just look up a few verses, in verses 39 to 41 of chapter 4, we're told that many became believers. So you've got this sort of paradox going on all the time. Those who should get it don't, and those who you wouldn't expect to get it do. So, of course, when we read in the brackets that Jesus has said a prophet has no honour in his own country, immediately we start thinking, well, okay, here we go again. Even though his own people should recognise him, they won't. And yet there's another twist there almost, because at first sight the opposite turns out to be true. They do actually welcome him. And we'll look at that in more detail in a minute. But the next thing we're then told in verse 46 is that Jesus heads off to the scene of his first triumph, to Cana, where it all started, where he turned the water into wine back in chapter 2. Now, it's confession time here. Can I ask who watches X Factor? Is there anybody who watches X Factor? Somebody smiling at me. In fact, you're a Strictly Come Dancing person, aren't you? There must be somebody here who watches X Factor. I haven't actually seen much of it this year. My daughters have moved on to other things, really. But apparently, there's a guy called Ben there. Ben is actually the boyfriend of the dance teacher who taught my younger daughters, Sophie and Emma. And I looked him up on the internet yesterday. He's on the front page of OK magazine with her. It's extraordinary. Now, on Tuesday, he went back to the pub that he used to sing at. And this pub is actually opposite where my other daughter, Sarah, works. And so it was apparently complete pandemonium. People everywhere. He went into the cafe next door, and Sarah's centre manager tried to get him to come in and talk to the kids because, you know, total pandemonium. A few weeks ago, he was a total nobody. He was a pub singer. Now he's a star. And I think that's the sort of thing we've got here with Jesus. You know, he's back in his homeland in front of an adoring public. And what's more, there's the whiff of another miracle in the air. Because in verse 46, we're told about a royal official. Now, we're not told exactly who he is, but as someone caught up in the rather murky social and political world of Herod, it's probably fair to say that he's another who wouldn't exactly have been flavour of the month to the general Jewish public. But the point is, he's got a son who's lying ill about 20 miles or so away in Capernaum. So, could Jesus be about to perform another healing? That's the picture, the scene set, and then the action starts when we get on to verse 47. And Jesus and the royal official are centre stage. The royal official hears that Jesus is back in Galilee, and with his son close to death, he does the only thing that he can do. He heads off from Capernaum to Cana and begs Jesus to heal his son. Now, what's critical to realise in what follows is that although the dialogue appears to be back and forward between Jesus and the royal official, there are actually some third-party onlookers here. Because when Jesus says, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you'll never believe," this wasn't meant for the royal official's ears only. Because it's pretty safe to assume that all around him were Galileans. So this comment was meant just as much for them as it was for the royal official. Why do I say that? Well, let's go back to the bit I skipped over, the second part of verse 45, which was the bit about why the Galileans welcomed him. They welcomed him, we're told, because of all that he'd done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival. And if you read back to chapter 2, verse 23, you'll see what he'd done there. He was performing signs. So here is the real reason that the Galileans welcomed him. They weren't seeing Jesus for who he really was at all. All they saw was Jesus, the miracle worker. And it's, you know, a little bit like Ben and the X Factor again, isn't it? The crowds aren't seeing Ben the person. They're just seeing Ben, the singer, the pub singer, turned superstar. And Jesus was saying, if that's all you see, the miracles I do, you're missing the point. You just don't get it. So what he's doing is he's issuing a really serious challenge here to the royal official and to the Galileans. He's saying, are you here for the things I can do, or are you here for me? And it's very similar, actually, if you were here last week. It's what Mark was talking about with the woman at the well. He asked the question, what are you thirsting after? Are you just thirsting for the worldly things, the thrill of the miracle, the desire for the spectacular? Or are you prepared to have your life transformed? Because if you're just thirsting for the miracle, you'll never, ever be satisfied. You might go away happy for a while, but when the thrill dies down, you'll just be back for another miracle next week. Now, there's a lot of different views held about the place of miracles in the church today. There's a few who think that they only happened in the first century. There's a few who think they can still happen pretty well on demand. And I guess most of the rest of us are somewhere in between, closer to one spectrum at one end of the spectrum than the other. But the point is that if you stand in the camp that believe Jesus still performs miracles today, Jesus' words here, they should make us think. Because the question is, are you just after Jesus the miracle worker who satisfies your demands, or are you prepared for him to radically transform your life as well? And perhaps also we should think about how the church may be portraying Jesus to the outside world. For example, if you've got Jesus advertised or set up as a miracle worker for an event or a service with the emphasis on a spectacle, what's that actually saying? You know, are people coming to be entertained, or are they coming to have their lives changed? And of course, who's being set up to take the glory out of this? Is it Jesus, or is it the church, or even the church leaders? Because the point is that wherever the emphasis is on the miracle, or on the church leader even, rather than on the person of Jesus, we have to stop and think. That just seems to be an obvious conclusion to draw from Jesus' words here. It's what he says to us today in exactly the same way that he said it to the Galileans then. So, of course, all this puts the royal official a little bit on the back foot, to say the least, because his son's dying. And the only thing that can save him is a miracle. So he tries to give it one more go. And in verse 49, he says, "Sir, come down before my child dies." And then all of a sudden, the tone completely changes. "Go," Jesus replied, "your son will live." So why does it all change? Well, the clue is probably in the word "sir," because that word can easily be translated "lord" or "master" instead. So although the royal official is desperate for a miracle, his words show that his faith sees beyond that miracle. He's got a glimpse of the Son of God behind it all, and he's ready to acknowledge Jesus' lordship over his life. And it's on the back of this faith that the miracle happens. And of course, this raises another potentially thorny issue. How much faith was Jesus looking for before he chose to perform this miracle? Because despite being meant for the bystanders as well, the words in verse 48 were primarily addressed to this man. So it does look like they were being used as a bit of a test of his faith. And it isn't difficult to find countless examples in the Gospels and the New Testament in general where a link between faith and miracles is clearly revealed. And equally, what's more, there are other cases where Jesus didn't perform miracles when faith was lacking. So just take one example. When he was in Nazareth, you can look this up in Matthew chapter 13. There's a comment there that says, "Jesus did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith." So some sort of link between faith and miracles is pretty clearly established. And yet we do have to be very careful here. Because if you believe that God still performs miracles today, what happens, say, if you start to say, "Well, oh, so-and-so, they didn't get healed because they didn't have enough faith, or someone else didn't have enough faith on their behalf." You know, have you ever come across that situation? It's an absolute nightmare. Absolute nightmare to deal with. And there are actually a number of answers you can give to this. But actually, there's one very simple one, straight from this passage, straight from Jesus' words back in verse 48. All you have to do is ask yourself this. Where's the focus of this person saying that? Is it on Jesus, or is it on the miracle? It's on the miracle, isn't it? That's all they're concerned with. You know, the miracle didn't happen. Why not? Someone's to blame. You know, there's got to be a reason. No thought at all given to God, his sovereign power, and how he's really at work in the situation. It's all completely and utterly worldly. And then you've got, of course, there's no ounce of compassion whatsoever for the person who's left feeling horribly guilty, trying to drum up this faith from nowhere. So I'm not sure that analysing the impact of faith on a miracle in a lot of depth is a very helpful thing to do. On the other hand, though, if you look at it the other way round and analyse the impact of a miracle on faith, now that is an entirely different matter. Because the point is, it's that faith is actually built on evidence. It's not something we have to drum up from nowhere. And we can see that clearly as we look back to the passage. Because the point is that the more evidence the official sees, the more his faith increases. And that ultimately then becomes a fountain that spills over from him to others. So if you go look at verses 47 to 49, what you see there is that the official starts by thinking that Jesus actually needs to go to Capernaum in order to heal his son. But then in verse 50, Jesus pronounces the healing, and he then realizes that no, that actually doesn't have to be the case. So what happens is he then sets off for home, actually trusting Jesus at his word. But it's only actually when he meets his servants that he gets concrete confirmation of his son being healed. And I don't know whether you noticed quite how long he has to wait for this, but in verse 52, we're told that it was actually yesterday when the healing happened. So that was quite a long time that he had to wait in between Jesus saying he's healed and then finally hearing, yes, that had actually happened. And yet there's still one further stage where the father's faith seems to move on, because what then happens, of course, is he realizes that the exact time that Jesus pronounced the word was the exact time his son had been healed. And then the effect of this is so profound that it's not just him, but his whole household who start believing. So it's very, very similar again to the lady at the well last week. As her faith grew, it naturally spilled over to others. And now, as the royal official's faith grew, it too spilled over to his household. Meanwhile, of course, this all got played out many miles away from the crowd back in Cana of Galilee. So did news get back to them of what had happened? Well, possibly, but they would have needed to have waited for quite a while. And those who'd come looking for a miracle to thrill them would probably have gone home rather disappointed. They may even have said it was a bit of an anticlimax, that this Jesus wasn't all he'd been cracked up to be by those who'd seen him in Jerusalem. And so, of course, that brings us to John's final comment in verse 54, which really brings us to the crunch. Do you see Jesus the miracle worker? Well, if so, are you prepared for him to turn your life upside down? Do you see that he's more than a prophet, more than a teacher, more than a miracle worker? Because if that's all we see, we're missing the point. He's actually the Word made flesh, the one we read about in chapter 1, whose birth we're going to celebrate in a couple of weeks' time. He's the royal son, a bit like the one we read about today, who died and came to life again. And he's the bridegroom who's gone to prepare a wedding banquet for his bride, the church, where we'll drink the new wine that we read about in Cana of Galilee. It's all there. It's all there in the first few chapters of John's Gospel, and there's actually loads more besides. And the question is, do we see it? Will we look at the evidence and be born again? Will we discover the living water which wells up to eternal life, both to us and to those we share it with? Or will we remain blind, searching for satisfaction from the things of this world, and yet always remaining hungry for more? Will we recognize the signs that John gives us, or will we ignore them? So really, it's the key question for all of us as Christmas approaches. Who do you say Jesus is? What do you see when you look at Jesus?